All right, well, we are going to get started. If you can hear me now, that means you have joined into the webinar. This webinar will be recorded and we'll be sending it out after we complete this session. We'll send it out to all our registration guests. So you will get that probably within the week. But as a quick introduction, this session is about the Fulbright Scholar in Residence program and it's focused on community colleges. One of the unique things about this session is we are actually joined by a host who I'll introduce in a moment, who will actually talk about their experience as a community college applying for the Scholar in Residence program and also implementing it on their campus. So without further ado, we'll kind of get started. My name is Sarah Causer. I'm an outreach and recruitment specialist at the Institute of International Education, and I'm going to quickly introduce the rest of my co-presenters for the day. So first off, we have Kaylee Atwater, who is also at IIE. Kaylee, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, sure. So I am Kaylee Atwater. I'm based in the DC office here at IIE. And I'm a placement advisor. I work with the Fulbright Scholar in Residence program through the process.
Wonderful. And next, we'd like to introduce David Levin, who is a senior program manager at the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs within the Department of State. David?
Hello, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. And one of my pleasures of my job is overseeing the Fulbright Scholar in Residence program.
Great. And then next, I would like to introduce our two kind of guest speakers for the day. The first is Dr. Rich Johnson from Harper College. Rich?
Hello, everybody. Excited to be here. I'm the Director of International Education at Harper College, a comprehensive community college on the outskirts of Chicago.
And actually, Rich, would you like to introduce our other guest speaker who is also with you?
Absolutely. It'd be my honor and pleasure to introduce my colleague and friend, Professor Jairo Viales of the National University of Costa Rica at the Sarapiquí campus, and I'll let him, he's been our Fulbright Scholar for the past 8 months, and I'll turn the floor over to him.
Okay, hello everyone. I'm glad to be here, trying to share our experiences with you all. Yeah, my name is Jairo. I work at Harper College, but I'm from Costa Rica. I work there for the National University of Costa Rica.
Wonderful. Well, I know I speak for everyone, Rich and Jairo, that we're so excited to have you both here on this webinar, and I know everyone will get a lot of great insights from both of your experiences on both the host side and the scholar side of participating. As a quick overview, as I said, this session is being recorded. We will send out the slides as well as the recording as soon as it is complete. And throughout the presentation, if you have any questions, please utilize the question box. You can direct them to Rich, Jairo, or Kaylee, myself, or David if you have any specific questions about the program. So jumping right in, this session we're going to start with a quick overview of the Scholar in Residence program as well as the Fulbright program as a whole. Then we'll jump into the application components led by Kaylee as well as tools and resources that are available to you as a potential host institution applicant. After that, we will be happy to pass the reins over to both Rich and Jairo to talk about their experience applying for the Scholar in Residence program. And then we'll wrap it up with other opportunities within Fulbright, followed by a question and answer section. So with that, we're going to jump right in. So the Fulbright Scholar program is part of the Fulbright program family as a whole. So the Fulbright program was established in 1946, and it allows U.S. academics and professionals to bring scholars to the U.S. as well as to go overseas. So the program itself was designed to strengthen the relationships between the people of the United States and the rest of the world, and it was established as a public diplomacy program. So this program's been going on for about 72 years, I think, at this point, and it's just continued to grow, and this program that we're talking about today is just one of the many facets of the program that we're really excited to share with you all. The Fulbright program is sponsored by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs and is administered by the Institute of International Education. So if you have any questions why there's so many people on this call, it's because there's so many moving components and organizations and people involved with the administration of this program. On this screen, you can see two different photos that really show the breadth of the program. The first one, which is in black and white, is one of the first scholars to Burma when they did open up their relations within Fulbright. And then the other photo is one of our Fulbright Arctic scholars on their grant. And so that program really allows different scholars from all of the Arctic regions to get together and conduct collaborative research as well as their individual research. So the program's just constantly been evolving and changing. So jumping into why you are on this call today, it's about the Scholar in Residence Program. So the Scholar in Residence Program is a unique opportunity for U.S. institutions to apply to bring scholars or professionals from abroad to their campuses. What's unique about this program is we're really geared towards institutions that might not be involved with the program as a whole, and there's a slide kind of about those specific institutions later on. But ideally, we're looking for institutions such as community colleges, which is the reason we have this specific webinar, along with also rural institutions and minority-serving institutions, and we'll show you the full breadth in a moment. But this program really allows you to apply to either name or request recruitment of a certain scholar to come to your campus for a semester or full academic year to teach a full course load. Ideally, this is an undergraduate course load, but if you have questions about graduate course loads, we can talk about that later. But traditionally, we're looking for these scholars to teach primarily at that undergraduate level. So we're currently soliciting applications for the 2020-2021 academic year. And what's unique this year is we actually moved our deadline back a bit. So the deadline is November 1st of 2019 for that following year. In the past, we've always accepted draft proposals that you're welcome to submit.
Sarah, I think that you cut out from my end, but at least, your audio. David or Rich, could you guys let me know if you can hear Sarah at all?
I can't.
Okay. Well, then I can actually jump in and take over while she's taking a look at it, if that's okay with everyone. So
sure.
I think that she was just in the middle of saying that our final deadline is November 1st, which is a little different from previous years. We're excited to be able to extend that. And then we have a draft deadline of October 1st, and that's a date by which institutions who are interested in applying or who are well on their way in the process can actually submit their material to us, and we can take a look then. And Sarah, are you back?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Perfect. All right. I am not sure what happened there. I do apologize for that, but thank you for taking over. At this point, David, did you have anything else you wanted to provide about the overview of the Scholar in Residence program?
No, I just to tell the audience that this is not like the typical Fulbright, which is more typically seen as a grant for an individual student or an individual scholar to go abroad or to come from overseas to the United States. This, on the other hand, is institutionally driven, so it's you as a community college are the primary point of reference applying to the program. And the other point I would make is, unlike most Fulbrights, which are geared toward the individual who does research or does teaching, various kinds of things to enhance their experience, while the Scholar in Residence certainly benefits from this program, the primary objective is to how this assists the U.S. host campus in their internationalization efforts.
That is actually a great segue, David, to our next slide, which does discuss the benefits for internationalization and globalization on campuses. Would you like to continue along that same track?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, good. So as I said, it's geared toward what your campus objectives are in terms of internationalization, short-term and long-term. And the idea is bringing the scholar to campus. The primary function is their teaching. As Sarah and Kelly said, it's primarily at the undergraduate level. But beyond that, as part of this concept of internationalization, the question we would ask is, what is your plan to engage that scholar that you're bringing in across campus in a whole variety of ways to interact with students, with faculty, with staff, beyond the courses that you're specifically teaching? And then, in a sense, the third leg of the stool is, what is the scholar doing within the surrounding community outside of campus to engage with the public, with the K-12 school district, with various professional organizations and social organizations as a way to build a stronger bridge between your campus and your community in, as part of this internationalization effort. So it's really we see it sort of as a three-legged stool. And clearly the best experiences for SIRs are when all three of these components are operating well within each other.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, David. Moving along that same line, as I was saying before, I got cut off, and again, I apologize. On the screen now, you can see the types of institutions that we really hope to engage with the Scholar in Residence program. So as you are joining in today, because you're coming ideally from a community college background, we are also seeking applications from institutions such as minority-serving institutions, which they're all listed on this screen, from Anapeses to Hispanic-serving institutions and historically Black colleges and universities, along to publicly Black institutions. We're also eager to engage with institutions that are from a small liberal arts college background, as well as rural colleges and universities. Now, if you are listening to this webinar and you're not from an institution that is shown on this screen, you're still more than welcome to engage and apply through the Scholar in Residence program, but we would actually encourage you to consider partnering with another local institution nearby. Now, that partnership could look like a full-year grant to where you might host the scholar for the fall, and then in the spring that scholar would actually be located on the local community college campus, something to that extent. So if you have any questions about that, we'd be more than happy to set up a session to speak with you and go over these other opportunities. One thing that we wanted to provide was the breakdown of this past year's SIR grants. So as you can see on the screen, this is what this current cohort looks like, the one that both Rich and Hayato are a part of. So as you can see on the screen, about 20% of the awarded grants went to community colleges in this last year. We're really excited to see this number continue to grow, and I believe, I'm going to fast forward to one slide and then I'll go back. As you can see, it has steadily grown from 2016. So this current year, that 20% is made up of about 7 institutions. So we're really excited to continue to see this trend increase. Moving backwards is a list of recent community colleges that have hosted SIRs. And so they're all listed on the screen as well as the countries that they did host. So it's a wide breadth of institutions as well as countries that have been hosting these SIRs. David, do you have anything else you want to add kind of regarding trends within the Scholar in Residence program?
No, I think community colleges have traditionally been strong and remain strong. In case you're curious, we target these types of institutions, community colleges, minority-serving institutions, small liberal arts colleges, rural colleges, defined as schools that are less engaged with international, perhaps, and or serving minority audiences. And community colleges, we think, in fact, lots of them probably meet both these criteria. We know that lots of community colleges are not as engaged internationally as they could be or should be or might like to be, and we also know that many community colleges serve large numbers of minority students. So in a sense, you really fit the target audience for us in terms of the kinds of schools that we are targeting to participate within Scholar in Residence.
Great. Thanks so much, David. And at that moment, I will actually pass the reins over to Kaylee, who will start to take you through the application components. Kaylee?
I will. Thank you so much, Sarah. And so I know that we really do want to focus today's session on actually hearing from Rich and Hiro, so I'll definitely run more quickly through some of these sections. That said, if you're interested in hearing a lot more in-depth detail about the application itself, what it looks like, click by click, even with screenshots, then Sarah will be talking about other webinars that we'll be holding throughout the rest of the competition through the summer and into the fall. So definitely keep an eye out for that, and she'll show you the schedule later on. first things first, if anyone's logging in who may have applied in the past or who was kind of looking through the application in the past year, you'll see that this year we're actually using a new application system. It's called Slate. Great, easy to use. The format has changed a little bit from last year. It's a little bit more intuitive now, we think, which is exciting, but the content itself remains the same. So you will see upon starting an application that there are some shorter application sections in which you enter text or use drop-downs, and then there will also be a section that I'll talk about in a moment that asks you to upload a number of documents. So one tip that we always give is that just really get in here and start an application. Just open it up, take a look at what's being asked of you, get a sense of all of the components, because I know that it can be really helpful to just kind of have it open in front of you, even aside from looking at the webinar. I'd also encourage you to take a look at the application guidelines, which again, I think Sarah will be linking to even within this, this PowerPoint presentation that she'll send out later. And those application guidelines really do go into great detail about the different components and kind of best practices for them also. So for these first sections of the application up on the screen here now, more basic, you'll mostly be writing in names and contact information in text boxes. A few pieces I want to highlight, though, is that it asks for two contacts here. One is an administrative official or anyone who can sign off on affiliation information or confirmation at your institution. And then the other is the principal contact for academic arrangements. So for both of these contacts, we know that each institution is different. We're not going to say that this has to be a dean or this has to be a professor, because we know that it can really look different at all of your institutions and colleges. Regarding program dates, as Sarah had mentioned, we work pretty far in advance, so we're actually in this open competition now. We're listing dates for the 2020 and 2021 academic year. You'll also be listing financial support here, and then also named versus recruited scholars. So you'll just list basic information here, and I'll be talking about that in a little bit more detail in a moment. And then there's also a proposal summary. So that's really important. It just gives our reviewers and our staff at IIE a snapshot as to what your program or your proposal entails. So it's very helpful if you use the section to highlight all of your major proposal pieces and kind of what it's all about. Okay, the next slide, Sarah. Okay. So at the end of this one, Rich and Jairo, I might toss this over to you to get your perspective, but I'll just run through these pieces first. So we are getting into this next section now called the narrative. This is really the main essence of the application. It's divided into two parts. So we have part one up here now. That's the institutional profile, and that is typically 4 to 5 pages. Or if you are doing a joint proposal that Sarah was talking about where you might double up with another institution, then it could be 7 to 8, so double the amount of pages. With this section, just keep in mind that reviewers may or may not know your institution. So this part of the narrative proposal is really key to getting them a better idea of your institution and who you are. So things you'll include in the institution profile include just more general information listed on the screen here. We find that it's helpful on your end to just break these pages down by section. So slotting in a few paragraphs under the mission heading and the academic offerings heading and then kind of on down the line. And that just kind of helps to organize everything on your end, but also for the reviewers to really see that you've hit all of these points. It's definitely helpful. So what we want to see is how your institution is set up, what you have in place, and alternately what you don't have in place on campus that a scholar in residence could help with. And this is also where you can indicate your institution's short and long-term goals and objectives. So what are you hoping to gain through internationalizing your campus efforts, and how would specifically hosting a scholar in residence fit into these goals? So David, actually, let's start with you. Did you have anything to add about this first part of the narrative proposal, any suggestions for the institution information?
It's really making a case for the the program that you're proposing, whether it's a named scholar or a scholar to be recruited, what would you like that scholar to do, and how does that fit into your objectives? We talk about short term being 1 to 5 years, and long term being 5 years or longer. How do you see this fitting into this internationalization concept, and how would this enhance that effort?
Mm-hmm. And then, Rich, as a writer of this and also a reviewer, anything to add from your end about this section?
Absolutely, thanks. I'd like to riff off of something you said, which is following the organizational pattern. As a writer, as a teacher of rhetoric, it's always important to do what you've been asked to do. And I think the logic of the proposal is key in terms of organizing your own thought, but then also making the case, making the scenario, as David suggested, really jump out to the reviewers. Ultimately, that's your audience. And I always see part one as kind of your moment to shine and say, hey, this is who we are. These are our students. These are the people who will be directly impacted by the beneficence of this amazing program. And we've been doing this, and this is how it'll be enhanced by this participating in the Scholar in Residence program. And the short and long-term internationalization goals and objectives should really be aspirational. I think all of that speaks well to your own programs, and I think speaks very clearly and directly to the reviewers themselves.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Rich. And it really is nice to have your perspective here for any of our listeners, because, again, you've not only put in an application, but you've also been on the receiving end where you've been reviewing. Yeah. So great to get your perspective. Everyone's lucky to have you.
thank you. I think it's exciting.
Yep. Okay. I'll put you on the spot again in a moment. And so we're moving on to part two here. So this is the second part of the narrative proposal. And this is really honing in on what the FIR program is going to accomplish for you. So again, I'll run through a few pieces here, and then I'll hand it over to David and Rich. So first off, with the oversight section here, you are addressing who on campus will be responsible and for what during the entirety of the visit. So in that first section, you had already identified two of those contacts, the administrative official and then the faculty associate. So in this section here, you're actually really, really jumping into this, getting background on those individuals and what they'll be doing with the scholar on campus. We have seen the oversight section take various forms, so there could be just a few faculty or staff listed here. There could also be a whole Fulbright steering committee that kind of pulls or engages from staff with different background on campus or from different departments. And again, this really is so specific to your individual college or your institution, so we just want to see what thought has been put into the potential scholars program on campus and that they and you as the host will be set up for success. We also have the academic program of the scholar. So here you'll actually talk about the qualifications or background that a scholar should have to meet your proposal's needs. As we've been saying, this is institutionally driven, so it always comes back to you as the people writing the proposal. And then you'll also be jumping into the need for the courses themselves. So we often get a question about how many courses a scholar might teach on campus. We see on average about 2 per semester, but we'll be hearing more from Rich and Jairo later with kind of how they've formatted everything. So sometimes the scholar might be teaching courses that are already designed and just bringing in a international insight into the curriculum that's already existing. And other times they might be creating a completely new course. So highlighting this in this section is important to reviewers to understand the amount of preparation that is going to go into completing these activities that you're outlining in the proposal. Be sure to discuss how the scholar will interact all across campus, even across the community. It should just show that you've thought through how to maximize the scholar's time and presence. in the whole community. And then for professional enrichment, as we've been saying, it's institutionally driven, but we also want to see that there's potential for the scholars' individual growth. So if you plan to include them in faculty meetings or attending academic conferences, then you'd note all of that here. And then sustainability. This is how you would sustain the scholars' activities after they leave. David, did you want to chime in on some creative, sustainable options that you've seen through the years?
Sure. So we've heard of everything from a relationship that was set up between the host institution and the scholar's home institution. Maybe that's an online course that's taught when the scholar returns home. Maybe it's student-faculty exchanges. We've seen connections between business communities, between home and host institutions and communities. We've seen connections between local chambers of commerce. We've seen connections between museums and libraries. So to think creatively about how can you sustain the benefits that you've had with the scholar here. Maybe the scholar is actually helping develop a class that you then implement after the scholar returns home, perhaps them teaching it, or a scholar doing it actually on your campus, but it's being derived from a course that your scholar may have developed while they were there. So think creatively about that. But the other point I would make, sort of in response to Kaylee's sort of listing of these different kinds of activities, and this sort of falls under the concept of grantsmanship. I think the one area where we see proposals that don't succeed and ultimately are not recommended for funding is where they've not necessarily focused on each of the categories. If you skip a category, if you're light on a category, it's going to be reflected in what the readers see, and it's going to count negatively against your proposal. So we really encourage you to look at this thing sort of incrementally, step by step, and make sure that you're sort of answering all the various components of the program that we're asking you to design.
Exactly. And as you're talking through that, David, through these sustainability points and ideas, you might be, like, I'm catching keywords that kind of tie sustainability to the long and short-term goals even. So as you're writing through this and as you're thinking through the process, you'll be seeing how they're all kind of working together and become this wonderful proposal that you'll be submitting to us. But again, I think that Rich can speak to a little bit later, too, about how it's been formatted for them successfully in the past. Okay, so then just the last piece on this page I want to mention is the financial support. So in a previous section, you would have just written in some dollar amounts in one of those text boxes that I was mentioning in the very first section. So here in this narrative section, you'll actually be expanding on those areas of cost share that you'll be able to provide. So cost share is encouraged. Institutions are asked to think creatively about ways they can provide this.
So they can actually augment the salary of the full rider coming in. Other schools perhaps can't, but they provide some kind of in-kind support. And people have said to me, what's sort of the range? And I guess I would say I've seen everything from zero to $50,000 as cost share. So we really do see, you know, a whole variety of possibilities, and we realize it's going to sort of be up to you as an institution as to what you can conceivably do.
Mm-hmm. And it really is, it's all case by case by institution, which we understand, and definitely reach out to us if you have any questions about your specific case. And then, Rich, anything to add to kind of wrap this section up from your side?
Absolutely. I see this as really the engine behind the whole application, and the deliberateness and connectedness and intentionality of all of these aspects, I think, is key to making the strongest case for your program. So just quickly, oversight. We typically have a team because there's so many facets of a scholar's visit on campus. The academic program is sort of like the heart of it. How is this scholar going to fit into your campus life? What is he or she going to do? And sort of, if it's a named scholar, do you have a department in mind? If it's not a named scholar, do you have an area, a discipline, maybe even sort of a division in mind? The hands are kind of the plans for other campus activities and the outreach. How are they going to be connected to the rest of the campus and into the community? We are community colleges, after all. The head of the enterprise is the professional enrichment. There has to, that piece has to be crucial. And Jairo has, he and I have just come back from, in terms of sustainability, come back from 2 weeks in Costa Rica where we were looking at different campuses of his particular university to create ongoing relationships and partnerships and participate in professional development opportunities for him and also for me. Jairo, do you want to quickly say something about that?
One of the objectives of this kind of programs has been like supporting both institutions, Harper College and my university in Costa Rica. As Richard said, so we have different branches and the main campus in Costa Rica. And we are trying to support our main campus, our campus in the National University of Costa Rica by giving some students and faculty the opportunity to think that they may be one of the ones that be that can make a difference in our campus by having this kind of opportunities.
So your professional enrichment going back is going to be important.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's great, and that's exactly the type of thing that we'd want to see as much as possible in this section, but we know that a lot of it you can't really predict, so we love to hear the stories afterwards, too, and as you're going through the process, and I think that David would agree. Okay. Thank you guys so much. And then, Sarah, do you mind going to the next slide here? Okay. So I am trying to go through this quickly. I want to give Rich and Jairo enough time to get to theirs. So moving on to the scholar itself. So after the narrative portion, we do want to hear more about the actual scholar that you wish to bring to campus. So the program allows for two different tracks. You can either name a scholar or ask for recruitment of a scholar. So for naming, you'd name a scholar in your proposal that maybe a faculty member has worked with in the past. So if you name a scholar, outline why that particular scholar best fits your particular grant. It's institutionally driven, so this is about you as the host. We ask that you submit a CV, two letters of recommendation. One should speak to a scholar's teaching ability, since they're coming to your campus to primarily teach. And then you'll also want to ensure that they have the required English skills to teach that topic on campus. If you don't have a specific scholar in mind or have those connections, that's no problem at all. You can request the recruitment of a scholar. You'll be able to choose two different countries within one world region. The regions are listed on our website. If you don't see something that you're interested in on the list, reach out to us to discuss. But in the proposal, you'll include information about the type of scholar that you want or would like us to recruit. And we'd actually then use these details that you provide here to reach out to our colleagues abroad and see if they'll be able to recruit a scholar within that discipline or specialization that you're requesting. So we ask that you outline the credentials of the scholar here, if there's a certain amount of teaching experience that they might need to teach on your campus, really anything that helps us to narrow down recruitment efforts. So we often get questions about if your chances are better to name or request recruitment for a scholar. David, did you want to chime in on this point of named versus
recruit? Sure. I would say that typically we probably get 60 or 70% of the requests are actually named scholars. But having said that, there's absolutely no difference in terms of whether your proposal will be approved or not for support, whether you named a scholar or asking a scholar to recruit. It really is based on what your needs are and what your capabilities are in terms of who you may know in advance or not. But typically, if you ask for recruitment, our Fulbright commissions or U.S. embassies abroad have wonderful connections and happy to work within their academic communities to recruit for you.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. And then the next slide, please, Sarah. OK. Okay, so this is another part of that main upload section that I was mentioning, from when you're actually logged into the application. So we ask for letters of support. So these letters of support here would directly relate to your institution and what you're applying to do. At a minimum, this should include a letter from your administrative official just saying that, yes, that scholar is welcome on campus, we can accommodate them, et cetera. And then there's no maximum to the number of letters you can include here. You can kind of seek out letters from different departments across the institution, even from neighboring institutions or high schools in the area that you might engage with. The engagement of the scholar can grow once the scholar arrives, so you're not bound to these letters of support by any means. This is just to show that there's excitement at the idea of having a scholar in residence in your community. And then there's also the sample syllabi here, so we just want to see what the proposed courses entail, get a sense for what it's about. If you're naming a specific scholar, you might have insight into exactly how they'd be able to teach and craft it in a way that will enhance that scholar's cultural perspective. But again, we understand that things may change. So this is just a sample, and it's not really the be-all and end-all that this is the syllabi that this scholar must use while they're on campus. Okay, and the next slide to review criteria. Okay, so once you move forward with your application, might be curious as to what the external review committee is looking for. We've kind of been touching on all of this along the way, given Rich's perspective as a reviewer. So just really ensure that all pieces are working together as a whole. Give the reviewers a picture as to what you're hoping to accomplish through the Scholar in Residence program. We already discussed most of these when we were running through the application components, but just to hone in on a few pieces here, you'll want to think through if the proposal is feasible within the time period. That's important. So making sure that they can actually complete the activities that are outlined in the period that you're requesting. Expand as much as possible on the types of community outreach and engagement, kind of creating that network across the institution. And then take the time to think through the sustainability element. You keep hearing us talk about that too, so are other professors sitting in and learning about this scholar's perspective in the classroom? What are they teaching to help sustain it? All things like that. So when we hear from Rich in a moment, we'll actually be able to see these pieces in action. But moving on to the review process and timeline, I'll actually hand it back to Sarah. And Sarah, if your audio is working well, do you want to jump back in here?
All right. Can everyone hear me again?
Yes, we can.
All right. Houston apparently is having some troubles with internet, so I do apologize. So in terms of the SIR review process, as we have said a few times, we did move back that application deadline to November 1st. So after November 1st, through the month of November, we'll actually be conducting that technical review of your applications, making sure nothing is missing, that you've uploaded all of those narrative components that are required. Then we will have that review committee meeting in December, and at that point they'll get together, they'll review all of the completed and submitted applications and make their decisions for who will move forward. In January, you will be notified of the outcome from that review process, whether or not you will be expecting to receive a scholar for the following academic year, or potentially if you are on kind of that backup list, and many times we will go to those alternate lists that you might actually get selected. And if that is the case, we'll kind of expedite that process for you. From January to February, ECA and the J. William Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board actually reviews all the proposals and finalizes the funding and budget. And then from in that same time period through April, we will confirm scholars if you have named the scholar, making sure that they can indeed accept this opportunity. or if your institution actually requested further recruitment of a scholar, that will be taking place at that same time period. So they'll be reaching out to scholars within the countries you specified, looking for and making sure that someone can meet those requirements, and then you will get kind of a slate somewhere between 4 to 5 scholars for you to review to see who actually kind of fits the bill for you. After that, the scholars will get their grant packets, and then they'll either come to your campus in the fall, towards the end of summer, or sometime in January for the spring semester. The last thing, as Kaylee pointed out earlier in this presentation, we do have links. So when this presentation is put online, you can actually click all of these links to our application guidelines, which are also in the online website as well, and I will be attaching them to the email to you guys as soon as this webinar goes live with the recording. As we said, the draft proposal is due on 10/1, so if you do want to submit it early to get our feedback, please make sure you submit it by October 1st, and just don't forget that the final application is due by November 1st. And with that, it is our privilege to pass the microphone over to Rich.
Thank you very much. I want to say that it's our honor and privilege to participate in this webinar and also to be part of the Fulbright family. At Harper, we organize all of our internationalization efforts around what we call the global region of focus. And as you can see there, it is really this intentional, deliberate cycle of programming and area studies focusing on a region of the world. Each of the 3 years has a particular focus. It's always been my philosophy that you cannot have a globalized student body if you do not have a globalized faculty. So we begin with faculty development, and we run what we call graduate seminars in area studies around this particular region of the world for that first year, and we do a 16-day field seminar in the region itself. And then the second year, we have a visiting faculty from that region. We've been very fortunate that Fulbright has been so powerfully productive for us in that area. And then in year two and three, we try to take students to that particular global region. You'll see that in 2014, from 2014 to 2017, we focused on East Africa, and we had a Fulbright scholar from Uganda, and we took faculty to Uganda and Rwanda, and students we took to Uganda and Zimbabwe. This three-year cycle began in 2017, and we're focusing on Latin America, and we took faculty to Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua, and we've had the good fortune of having Jairo on campus for the past 8 months from Costa Rica. And we've also, during that time, had a number of students participate in study abroad programs in Guatemala and Nicaragua. The next slide is just a quick overview of our former Fulbright Scholar in Residence, Jimrex Byamugisha from Makerere University. And you can see there from the numbers the impact that he had in just the 4 months that he was on campus. And so it ranged from lectures to his own professional outreach and programs to his own personal enrichment, and then of course the ongoing impact is that we took students to that area. We have shared in teaching materials. We have jointly published particular studies in his dissertation and PhD area studies is banana production, and so our biology faculty has worked with him on some of his research. The next slide I'm going to turn over to my friend and colleague Jairo Viales.
Yeah, this is what I've been doing up to now. Once I got here, I didn't expect that I was going to participate in different events, not only at Harper, but abroad, let's say, different states. So that has helped me to be like more open-minded. And then this has been like a challenge, and I've been collecting a lot of experience from faculty and students, and actually work for the ESL department, and I also support the TESOL program that this department has. So I've been tutoring, basically what I do is tutor students twice a week, plus the classes that I have to teach together with some of the faculty at the TESOL program. And besides that, I also support the geology department, sociology department, geography department, and history department, as well as the diversity department. So giving them and the students some lectures about some of the topics that they have to teach according to their syllabi, and supporting the student with their different topics and lectures that they really need to talk about.
You can see from the numbers there the impact that this program has. On campus alone, Professor Vialis has given 88 lectures, workshops, presentations, and impacting 2,008 students. Those are numbers you can take to the bank. You can take to your administration and say, fund all of our international goals. And then also the outreach programs in four different states. He's participated in 20 programs. The ongoing partnership, as I mentioned, we have gone to Costa Rica and we're looking to build a unique partnership between Harper College and his particular university, his campus in particular. Do you want to speak quickly to an opportunity you had in Alabama?
Yeah. Once I got there, we met with the faculty and some of the deans that work for the School of Education. So we already have like a partnership with the University of Alabama at Birmingham. So we are trying to support that School of Education mainly for the master program that they have based on the TESOL certificate program that they offer. So we are trying to support this university because the students at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, they must apply for the practicum, so they are going to be in our campus in Costa Rica to develop their practicum as the final project before getting their master certificate. So as well as we are doing that with Harper College, we are trying to make this partnership by doing the same, because we offer here at Harper this TESOL program, and so we are honored to support Harper College with this program as well as vice versa. So we are trying to send our students and maybe in the future to come here and apply to our faculty to apply for these programs or support this department.
I think that you can tell how successful this has been by the fact that he used the first person plural pronoun, we here at Harper. He is indeed become a member of the family.
Absolutely.
And it's amazing. In the interest of time, we'll quickly move to the next slide, if that's possible. Thanks. And here is just a list of lessons that we have learned through this process. It really, in thinking back on things that that Kaylee, Sarah, and David have said, really it's about intentionally building your vision into the application process, and making sure that all of these pieces, all of the aspects of the application are integrated to one another and represent. It doesn't have to be a lockstep sort of nightmare of a process, but it really needs to be a sort of an intentional process that reflects your aspirations, your goals. We do, as I said, we have a steering committee. We think about offering meal plans on campus, although sometimes that, depending on who your food provider is, can be tough. Housing, transportation, and then connections, really making sure that you're thinking about the scholar's area or area of interest or discipline, and thinking about connections with local educational institutions and conferences that that particular scholar may be able to participate. And then I think Sarah's going to talk about this, but there's an amazing opportunity called the Occasional Lecture Fund that allows you as a community college to bring other scholars who are already in country at other institutions to your campus, and also to have your scholar to travel to other places. And Jairo, that's how he got to Alabama, to University of Alabama, Birmingham, to Jefferson State College, and various other places. Oh, and just got back from Iowa at Wartburg College. So really, it's an amazing opportunity. And This is just a quick sketch of the lessons that we've learned. And the next slide represents our sort of inspiration, how this idea of the Scholar in Residence program has been fundamental and foundational in our internationalization efforts, but has also represented really the sort of living soul, the inspiration of our internationalizations on campus. And rather than bore you with reading these particular goals, you'll see that really it's about making sure that the increasing the productivity of having that scholar on campus, that it fulfills your short-term and long-term goals and builds out the opportunities to continue the excellent work that we do in international education across campus, and speaking to all sorts of constituencies, stakeholders on campus, from staff to HR to faculty to support staff in tutoring centers to community organizations, whether it's Rotary, Lions, organizations in your particular community, chambers of commerce, et cetera. So really, we have been honored to participate in this program. I've had the good fortune of being both the author of applications, but also a reviewer and gotten some insights that way. And we're happy to share our experiences if anyone wants to contact us. So thank you for having us.
And I think Sarah and David, you might be doing this also, but as you're talking through this, it's just so exciting to hear it from your side and from also the scholar side. You can't see me, but I'm nodding a lot, and I'm just very excited to hear it. So it's wonderful.
Great. No, we're huge Fulbright fans.
I will second that. If I ever need a great alumni voice, I always know who to go to first, in my opinion. So thank you guys both so much for the insights. I know we have some questions actually coming in for you that we'll get to in a moment.
Okay.
So I will quickly wrap up our portion, and we're just going to go straight into the Q&A. But Kaylee said we would put up the upcoming webinars. So as you can see, we have this one today is focused solely for community colleges. We have others focused for minority serving institutions, rural colleges, and small liberal arts. So if anyone is listening and you know a colleague at another institution that kind of falls into this realm, please feel free to pass the link to them and encourage them to consider applying for the Scholar in Residence program. Additionally, we do have the application walkthrough coming up in early summer on June 4th that we highly encourage you to call in and listen to Kaylee give a thorough summary of the new application system, which I'm also excited to listen in on. And then we will have two last call webinars, one before that draft proposal deadline and one after. So in case you do not submit a draft proposal but have those last minute burning questions, we highly encourage you to sign up for those webinars as well. You can sign up for all of them, listen to the recordings. There's nothing wrong with doing any of that. As Rich mentioned, and as Jairo also talked about, we do have the Outreach Lecturing Fund that lets you as a U.S. institution apply to bring, on a short-term basis, a current Fulbright Visiting Scholar or Scholar in Residence to your campus to talk about their experience. Jairo was quite sought after by many institutions this year, and I actually know why. He is wonderful to work with.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So if that is of interest to you in the interim while you're waiting to find out if your application is selected, I highly encourage you to utilize this fund as well. It is a travel award, so you'd be applying. You'd give the scholar funding to travel, and if your institution does not have funding to provide housing for those 2 to 6 days, you're also welcome to request additional funding. So if you have any questions, feel free to email me at olf@iie.org, and I'd be happy to work with you there. And with that concludes kind of our informative part of this presentation. We'll jump into the Q&A. David and Kaylee and my emails are on the screen, as you can see here, so feel free to send any questions to sir@iie.org. Kaylee and I are both in that daily, and as Rich and Jairo mentioned, feel free to reach out to them with any questions. But with that, we will jump into the questions, and it looks like we have one. is about requesting specific scholars. Is there a list of available scholars who are working with a Fulbright organization for this purpose? I can offer my insight, and then Kaylee, please feel free to take over. We don't currently have an active list. Typically, if you're requesting a scholar, this is a scholar that you or potentially a faculty member have met at an international conference or have completed work with in the past. And so that tends to be what really facilitates that. Otherwise, many institutions actually request us to locate a scholar. Kaylee or Rich, would you like to offer your insights there as well?
Sure. We've done both. We came in contact with our Ugandan colleague, and while we were there and developed a relationship and came back and wrote a specific proposal and plan for him, and were successful in that. And then this time around, we had general disciplines in mind and a region of the world, and landed our wonderful colleague Jairo. So it can go either way. I was interested in the split that David mentioned. I hadn't realized it was that heavy to one to the other, but I don't think that it necessarily ought to prevent one from producing an application if you don't know whom your scholar would be.
And yeah, just from my end, this is Kaylee again. It just depends on if you're naming someone specifically. We do have some databases that we could direct you to that you could take a look at if you're interested in, but otherwise we would be just deferring to your own connections, or alternately, if you're looking for recruitment for a scholar, then you would kind of be deferring to us. So, Rich, another question that's come in that I want to pitch to you right away is grant length. So how did you pick your grant length, and what considerations did you kind of take into account as you were going through that process on your side?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. So the length that you were proposing, so a semester versus a full academic year, what did you do and why? I guess.
Yes, I'm sorry. So we were fairly cautious for several reasons. One, we wanted to make sure that we had a sufficient balance of work and professional enrichment for the scholar. So our first time out we wrote the application in 2014, the scholar came in 2015, we only asked for a semester. And that was also tied to our financial situation at that particular time as well. So those were some of the considerations in that. We were actually very fortunate and surprised that our second time around we built the application for Professor Vialis's visit around a one semester program, and then IIE got back to us and said, well, would you consider doing it for a longer period of time? And I said, wow, let me think about that. And I went back to our team and we sort of talked about what that might look like and whether we could sustain a variety of activities, and we decided that absolutely we could. And so we were able to broaden, deepen, and enrich the experience by taking an extra day or two to think about that. But really that opportunity was presented to us by IIE and State Department, and we took full advantage of it and are very, very happy we did. I think moving forward, we'd want to balance several things, and it really comes down to the impact the scholar can have on campus and the professional enrichment opportunities for the scholar. I think you have to think of them sort of hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. And that's perfectly put. And you definitely were in a bit of a unique position, I know.
Yeah.
And David, you might want to chime in on this in a moment, too, in that the review committee, when they're looking at these proposals, they might have some concerns about a certain period of time given the activities that are proposed, and they might have a requirement for a different grant length or a suggestion for doing something differently. And that's when IIE or on behalf of the Department of State and the review committee would go back and just kind of work through those conditions or concerns. So that is definitely a bit of a more rare case. David, did you have any insight into that too?
Sure. So I think in it's really sort of up to individual campuses, as Rich said, but I think my own perspective, I sometimes think that a full academic year is better because it may take the scholar, for example, a few weeks or a few months to, in a sense, become acculturated to their new environment and the new institution and the course that they're teaching and so forth. And it seems in the case of a full academic year, they then sometimes take this time to adjust and they hit their stride during second semester. So if you only have a semester grant, they're sort of peaking at the point that they're then finished with the grant, and it's sometimes a shame that they're not here for that second semester to really, expand on what they've done. So I think, it's up to each individual campus, but I think sometimes if the full year fits with your needs and so forth, we think maybe that's often the better way to go.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes for a joint proposal, a full year makes a lot of sense for the very reasons that David just outlined.
And for both of these cases, single semester versus full year, just for single semester especially, you want to be looking at sustainability afterwards because you are kind of getting into the swing of things. So what are you going to do to kind of keep that momentum moving? So just keeping that in mind. And then, Rich, do you guys have time for one more question? I know we're a little bit over, so we can definitely cut it off.
Of course, absolutely.
Okay, so just a kind of insight into the internal workings for you from, since this is for community colleges, I guess from a community college perspective, what kind of wrangling did you need to do internally as you were going through the application process itself? And you're welcome to talk about the next steps too, but I feel like that's a lot to get into. So, yeah.
So fortunately, because we had a sort of intentional plan for internationalization, pitching the idea of hosting a scholar on campus was not a tough sell to our administration, to our provost. Our president has, while not been entirely hands-on, he has certainly given us the green light and stepped out of the way, if you will. We are also fortunate that we have an independent budget line, so we had some resources and opportunities that might not be available to others. Nevertheless, I think tying this idea of a scholar's visit to your goals, as David and Sarah and Kaylee all mentioned, I mean, tying them to short-term, long-term goals is key in removing obstacles from people internally who may feel that this is a luxury or some sort of an opportunity that isn't appropriate for your institution. I'm a planner, so we had very deliberate steps and processes in terms of writing the grant. Although I wrote it, it was built upon a lot of application, a variety of different resources, reaching out to communities, members and to stakeholders on campus. And then really, I mean, from everything to doing that and building the steering committee and team to having folks invite him to classes, in this case him being Jairo, making sure that we had a plan in place for his departmental home, that he would be a full-fledged member of that department, attend meetings, and participate in the life of the campus in a meaningful way. From all of that sort of thing to then figuring out, okay, gosh, how are we going to furnish his apartment? We arranged for an apartment that for which he signed the lease, but we populated it with donated items. And I rented a truck, and six or eight of us moved the stuff in. So it's really all of those sorts of things and everything in between, but being sort of anticipating what the needs, potential needs of the scholar may be, whether it's from making sure that he's got post-it notes on his desk to what classes he's going to teach, to where he's going to eat, all of those sorts of things. And it was a team effort on our part.
And this is, I mean, it's so invaluable having you on this, just kind of thinking through those processes from your end. I know it's appreciated. And I know that's also a reason that Sarah does say that outreach lecturing fund, and you said this also, Rich. It's just hosting those shorter term scholars on your campus really help you kind of work through those processes in a very real way. So
a brilliant way to get your feet wet,
Yeah, great. So for everyone out there listening to, you know, just give us a call or we can connect you if you're ever unsure about a certain process, if you want to hear about a best practice or something that you kind of need to think through a little bit further in detail. I think that the number that's listed on the website that Sarah's linked to throughout this comes to my desk directly, so feel free to call anytime, shoot us an email, and we can set something up that way also. Sarah, I don't know if you wanted to jump back in or David too.
I'll actually let David go first, and then I'll finish it up.
All right.
Awesome. Well, I would just like to thank you all for tuning in. I hope that you're excited and enthused by what you've heard. You know, I know I get excited just hearing about how this works, and I get sort of doubly excited when I hear from Rich and Hira, who sort of give us the real you can hear from Washington and Houston, and we can give you sort of the official spin, which I think we do. I think we do it well. I think we demonstrate the program is great, but I think hearing from our colleagues at Harper, you know, about how this is has worked in real time, and really exemplifying how they've done this, I hope really increases your enthusiasm and demonstrates for you how this would be a real benefit for you to do on your campus.
Absolutely, and I couldn't say that better myself. I think SIR and opportunities like OLF really generate a lot of excitement, as we've heard throughout. Everyone here has just talked about how excited they are for this program. So we do hope you will consider applying for this program and get excited about it. And as Kaylee said, please feel free to reach out. But I also want to once again just really thank both Rich and Hira for taking the time out of their day to be on this presentation and offer up their expertise that they've had with this program. We hope you continue to be involved with this program. But thank you again for taking the time.
Absolutely. And I don't know whether it's appropriate to this venue, but I'm happy if you say yes to offer that and happy to talk to anybody probably longer than they want to talk about it and tackle any questions or issues. This is an amazing program.
Well, thank you again so much, and to everyone listening, thank you for taking the time out of your day to join. Sorry we went over a bit, but we hope to work with you in the future and just submit any questions. And if you do want to get in touch with Rich, please let us know, and we'll make sure to facilitate that connection.
Thank you, Sarita. thank you, everyone.
Thanks,
Kaylee.
Thank you, everybody.
All right. Have a good day.
You too. Thanks.
Bye. Thanks.